And I think Da Vinci is very influential. Latest estimates are that 40 million people have purchased this book, and those 40 million books have been read by an estimated 100 million readers. I came down from Canada. I was up in Calgary last couple days. And that doesn't bother me either. I'll just keep going on. Up in Calgary, they told me about a survey that was taken in Canada recently. 1 in 5 Canadians believes the ideas in Da Vinci are true. 1 in 5 Canadians. Now, the people who told me that said, you know, they said, we're a lot more secular society than you folks are down there. But isn't it amazing in that kind of a context, sort of like goes to what Greg was saying last hour, in that kind of a context where you can be more secular, the things that are in, you know, you can still say this is my view and this is true. And, you know, that's sobering. So as we talked and prayed about what I should be doing, what each of us should be doing up here this week, I thought, you know, I'd rather talk about resurrection. If you know me, that's all I ever want to talk about. Here comes Habermas. He's doing another paper on the resurrection. He thinks the resurrection is the answer to everything. That's because Habermas really believes that. That's correct. And that, you know, we have a breakout session tomorrow, so I want to talk about the resurrection tomorrow. And I'll say this before I get started. I do not have a book on my table on Da Vinci Code. I do have a book called Historical Jesus, where I critique the book on which Da Vinci Code is based, Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and a whole bunch of other aberrant views of Jesus. I feel like calling it the Jesus Debunkers or something like that. But I will tell you this. Carl Payne, who introduced me, has a book on Da Vinci. And it's right around the corner from my table. His is the first one there on the corner. And I'd recommend you go by there and pick up a copy of his book and his transferable cross-training series. And you can get some details. Folks, a lot of people have made a lot of critiques about Da Vinci. And it's not just right-wing fanatics that are critiquing Da Vinci. In fact, one of the most prominent skeptics in this country, a religious agnostic, published a book against Da Vinci, published by Oxford University Press. That's Bart Ehrman at University of North Carolina. So pretty much what people on the left and on the right agree, they agree on the idea that Da Vinci has a lot of historical problems and other issues. And I'm here primarily to talk about historical issues. One other thing, let me say, stay tuned, because the things that have broken and been breaking on the news in the last 2 weeks are going to put Da Vinci to shame. Unfortunately, they're almost all critical of Christianity. About 2 weeks ago, I got a call from John Ankerberg. A lot of you know who John Ankerberg is. He's the moderator for a Christian debate and talk show program that reaches about 90 million American households. And he called me and he said, hey, what are we going to say about this and this and this and this? I don't even want to mention the titles because I can't deal with them up here tonight. But he said, hey, do you think you could come on 1 week from today and tape 6 programs? I said, I haven't seen the books yet. He said, I know. I'll have 2 at your house tomorrow, 1 at your house the next day. I said, I've got another speaking engagement before I get to your place. He said, I know. I'll have them all there before you leave. So I took 2 grad assistants with me. All 3 of us were reading. All 3 of us were comparing notes. And in John Ankerberg's words, it's important to at least get a bullet in the elephant's leg. He said, I'll have you guys back in a few months and we'll take the elephant down. But let's at least get a bullet in his leg. People have to know that there's some responses. Some of the, you know, that's cute. You know, here come the books and I'm reading on the run and having to do a critique. Folks, there's a lot of critiques out there today. And here's what they have in common. Christianity is bunk. All right, and let me tell you the main bunko historical idea today in Christianity. It's taken from a book that was published in the 1930s by a German scholar named Bauer. And the book teaches this. And almost every one of these Christian aberrations, I say not Christian, non-Christian aberrations, teaches a form of this. And here's how the argument goes. In the early church, there were several kinds of Christology. And everybody picked their own Jesus. Okay? In Greg Kokel's words, this view is a what view? It's an ice cream view. You pick your own Jesus. You pick your own Jesus. And they're all floating around in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s AD. I'm going to tell you something. It's been my life's pursuit to read those sources from those periods and for another 100 years. And I'm going to tell you something. There's nothing like that in history that doesn't stop these critics. All of these theories, including Da Vinci Code, are ideas in search of evidence. Let me tell you what I mean by that. They're going to teach a view that says there's a lot of Jesuses, and if they're really, really bold, they're going to say these ideas diverged in the earliest church. And if you lived in the earliest church, you could have worshipped a blank Jesus or a blank Jesus or a blank Jesus, and you could fill in the blank. And every people group and every nationality and every kind of moral choice you could make or immoral choice, you can find a Jesus that fits you. And the early church had a bunch of those, and you could pick and choose. But there's no evidence for any of this. No evidence for any of this, as you'll see in a few minutes. But lately, a lot of these books have this in common. I think we found something. We're going to move it back from 200 AD to 125. We're going to move it back from 125 to 90. And, you know, just maybe there's some little hints that move it back from 90. I'm going to make a prediction. And I did this on the John Ankerberg show last week. We are going to continue to see groups producing evidence of, actually before Greg even gave this lecture, what I have called for years, ice cream Jesus. We're going to see people producing evidence that everybody can make Jesus in his or her own eyes. And some of these books have recently come out. Now, interestingly enough, so far I haven't even found a liberal that thinks these books are worth their historical salt. But it's going to really affect the person on the street. All right? So having said that, I'm caught between two things. I would rather do more solid historical stuff than to respond to people. And secondly, if we're going to respond to people, I'd rather respond to other people other than a novel. But since this is the one that's hitting the fan right now on May 19th, you know the movie's out, and two of our family heroes from Hollywood, you know, how can you get Opie producing this thing and, you know, it just looks like a... like too good to be true. Like, how can you deny this? It just must be true. Look at Tom Hanks. All right, let's go ahead and roll with that kind of thought. By the way, in case you're wondering, in the nature of total disclosure, I did not paint that picture up there. I just want you to know that before we begin, okay? All right, let's go ahead and take a shot. This is part one. Part two is going to be one of the breakout sessions tomorrow, Lord willing. And I'm going to go after a few ideas here, and most of the ideas I have to go with, I'm going after tonight, have to do with Jesus, and go after this kind of view I'm talking about, that there are divergent pictures of Jesus, and you can kind of pick and choose. Part two, in case you're interested, is more about Scripture, and the view that there are alternative Gospels, and how dare we pick the ones we pick and be so intolerant as to rule out in Dan Brown's heroes terms, 80 other, there's 80 gospels, and we burned the other ones. I bet you didn't know that. Didn't happen, but, you know, it's in the novel. All right, let's go ahead. There we go. Well, this book, I mean, sorry, this page, after the title page, has been much discussed. Fact. And three things follow after this. Here's one of them. All descriptions of artwork, architecture, documents, and secret rituals in this novel are accurate. Now, I think, I have been told, I do not know, I have been told that Dan Brown has backed off of this. I have been told that Ron Howard has said something to the effect of, it's a novel, enjoy it, don't think it's history, something like that. And that's fine if people realized, you know, that's what's going on. But there was early on when the book was first making its rounds that Dan Brown was on a talk show, a prominent talk show with one of our best-known American interviewers. And the interviewer asked, if this book were a history book instead of a novel, how would it look differently than it does? And Dan Brown said, it would look basically the same. It says novel on the front, but if it's history, I guess we could just take novel off, put history on, and it's okay. Now, that's the kind of idea I want to examine through several charges. Let's take a look at a couple here. First of all, aimed at Jesus. Here's Brown's character, Tebeen. He says that at the Council of Nicaea, Constantine upgraded Jesus' status almost four centuries after his death. Constantine is the critic. That's mild compared to some of the claims that are just coming out. Some of the more recent claims are that this split between the divine and the non-divine Jesus is very, very early. That's one of the latest claims. All right. But this is blamed on Constantine. And he says four centuries later he's incorrect about Constantine's time there, but more about that. All right, secondly, Tebeen continues. Until that moment in history, Jesus was viewed by his followers as a mortal prophet, a great and powerful man, but a man, nonetheless, a mortal. But this all changed at Nicaea, and Jesus was declared to be divine by a relatively close vote. This is like a relatively close football game. We'll see in a minute. All right, let's move to some ideas here of critique, okay? Did Jesus claim that he was deity? Now, let's remember Brown's charge. The charge goes like this. Jesus was viewed as a man by his followers until Constantine stirred the pot in about 325 AD, and until that time, nobody thought of him as deity. I'm going to propose two arguments under 2A and 2B. And this is the heaviest the lecture gets tonight, either part one or part two. So hang in there with me through 2A and 2B, and we'll be cruising the rest of the way. Okay? Here's the two questions I want to ask. 2A, did Jesus teach he was deity? That would destroy this thesis. And did the earliest followers of Jesus teach he was deity? That would also destroy the thesis by about 200 years. Okay, and I'm going to use a principle that some of you know I've developed this and worked on. I don't have time to explain it right here, but I call this the minimal facts argument. And let me tell you how the minimal facts argument works. When I go to secular campuses, I'll usually take a Bible, and I'll say, a lot of you seekers or non-Christians have a question that goes something like this. You want me to believe the man? Yeah. The man's in the book? Yeah. I don't believe the book, so I don't believe the man. That's a very crafty question. Sort of like the ones you've heard raised tonight. You want me to believe the man? Yeah. He's in the book? Yeah. Well, I guess if the book is correct, well, then it's correct. But I don't buy the book, so I don't buy the man. Now, this is an apologetics conference. I'm curious. I won't call on anybody. I won't pull anybody in the spot. But if somebody said that to you, you want me to believe the man. The man's in the book. I don't believe the book, so I don't believe the man. How many of you think you know where you'd go on that question? How many of you? I won't bug you or embarrass you. Okay, folks, I may be missing this, but it looks like there's only like a dozen hands up in here. That kind of confirms my view that that would stump most Christians. Now, those who might have their hands up might take a very popular tack in apologetics, and it's a different kind of argument that we'll use tonight. But the argument says this, the one some of you might be thinking of, and you can go this way. The argument says, don't you know the New Testament's a very reliable book? Consider arguments A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Now, in this very reliable book, we learn A, B, C, D, things about Jesus, and therefore, this picture of this man is a reliable picture. Oh, and by the way, he's not just a man. Same book, same reasons. I'm going to propose a different method. And I call it the minimal facts method. And basically, here's the deal I'm going to make with you. I'm only going to use texts which are respected in the critical community that are used by atheists and agnostics and others who teach New Testament at state universities and other places. I'm only going to use texts which they think are credited for any of several reasons. And I'm not going to be able to give you the reasons. I'll be glad to chat with you if you catch me around here tomorrow. But I'm going to use texts that critics accept. Now, let me first of all give you an objection that almost no critic will ever use, but somehow Christians think all critics use this objection. And here's the thing. You're going to use verses from the New Testament? Yep. But I thought you said you only use verses critics accept. Yep. But the verses are in the book. Yeah. I thought you said you weren't going to use the book. I didn't say that. Now, if you want to do that, we can talk that way. That's another whole argument. That's a different argument. And it's, again, that historical Jesus book out there has a dozen and a half sources outside the New Testament. Not a single one of them is Christian. And those sources are going to tell you dozens of things you can know about Jesus. And not a single one is, like I said, it's not Christian. That doesn't impress critics too much. I don't think it's the best argument. But you can do this argument and use nothing but ancient non-Christian texts. You can do that. But here's the principle I want you to understand. It's probably the single most important principle. Critics will allow you to use the Bible as long as you are using texts that can be defended on their own grounds. So I will not use any text that cannot be defended multiply, for multiple reasons, from different angles. That's the minimal facts argument. In other words, let me say it a different way. Critics don't care where you get your data. Even if it's from the Bible, as long as there are reasons for accepting those texts. Here's what you can't do. Quote a verse to quote a verse. Here's what you can do. Quote a verse that the verse you're quoting has reasons to accept that text. And those reasons are generally historical. So you've got to do your homework. It's a harder argument, but it's a lot more impressive argument because your methodology plays on their ball field. It's a heads I win, tails you lose argument. I'm going to do this with the resurrection tomorrow, Lord willing. But basically, here's the argument. If the Bible is inspired, Jesus is raised from the dead. If the Bible is not inspired, it's only reliable, Jesus is raised from the dead. If the Bible is neither inspired nor reliable, it's just a book of ancient literature, Jesus is still raised from the dead. Conclusion, Jesus is raised from the dead. That's the argument we're going to use. Only I'm not doing resurrection tonight. I'll mention it briefly, but I'm going to use this argument for the deity of Christ. So just know, I'm going to put verses up there, and you're just going to see verses. Unless you've studied these, you won't know the reasons why I'm using them. I'll drop a few hints along the way. But I'm using critical passages that critical scholars respect. And here's our two issues, once again, 2A and 2B. Did Jesus teach his own deity? And did his earliest followers teach his deity? Those are my two questions. So let's go ahead and go to some critical passages here. And I'm going to talk about two titles. There's other ways we can get here. But I'm going to talk about two titles Jesus used of himself. And this is the slow sledding here. This plus the methodology I just explained, but let's wait on in. I'm going to talk about two titles, A1 and A2, Son of Man and Son of God. Now, many pastors have said, I hear this a lot from students, my pastor said that Son of Man is Jesus' human nature and Son of God is his divine nature. My response to that is, not true. Son of Man is at least as high a title for deity as Son of God is. They're both titles of deity. Let's talk a little background. You say, well, listen, in the Old Testament book of Psalms, for example, Son of Man means a mere man. You're correct. Further, book of Ezekiel, almost 100 times, Son of Man means prophet. Almost 100 times. Prophesy, O Son of Man. You're correct. And in a very enigmatic passage, in Daniel 7, 13 and 14, Son of Man is a very different person. Daniel is giving a prophecy, and he said, I looked in my night visions, and there was the Ancient of Days. So you can't make a mistake and say, this is the person Christians call God the Father, because that's the Ancient of Days. Son of Man, you know, that's a different person. And Daniel says, and one came forth from the Ancient of Days, who was likened to a son of man, and he comes to earth and sets up God's dominion, and some translations say, all nations of the world worship him. Go, whoa, in a Jewish book? Yep. All nations of the world worship him. Now, most translations say, all nations of the world serve him. Hey, what is it? Worship or serve? There's a world of difference between worship and serve. We serve people. We worship God. What's the problem? The problem, it's not a problem, but the key here, is a Greek word. You say, well, Daniel's not written in Greek. No, it's not, but the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, which is the most used form of the Old Testament in the New Testament. The word is latruo, and the word there in Daniel 7, latruo, means to serve. That solves that issue. But of the more than 100 times that that word is used, it always means, except one little time in well over 100 usages, latruo means to serve in the context of worship. In other words, to serve in the temple, or to serve the God of the universe. So latruo is a term that means to serve, but to serve worshipfully, or to serve God. Okay, fine. So Son of Man can mean man, yep. Can mean prophet, yep. And can mean this enigmatic figure who was worshipped or served in a worshipful way, yes. Which is it? That's pretty easy. What you mean is, what did Jesus mean by Son of Man? That's kind of easy. Just look at his uses of Son of Man. And he uses it in three ways. As a substitute for first person, like a third person reference to himself. Secondly, to predict his death and resurrection. That's strange, because the Old Testament Messiah, according to current belief in the first century, the Messiah was not supposed to die, he was supposed to overthrow the Romans. We see that on Palm Sunday. Thirdly, here's the key one. Thirdly, the Son of Man is one who would come at the end of time, and all the nations of the world would worship him. He will set up God's throne. And this figure is sort of an otherworldly figure. As lightning strikes from the east to the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be, Jesus said. And it's that Daniel 7 usage that Jesus catches on to the most. How do you know? Because twice he paraphrases Daniel 7, 13 and 14. So we know what he means by Son of Man. Now watch the two usages that I have up here on what Jesus does. Mark 2, 1 through 12. Very familiar story. Jesus is preaching. And They take some tiles off the roof and they put a man down. And Jesus says to him, "Son, your sins are forgiven." And the Jewish leaders rightly respond, "You can't forgive sin. No man can forgive sin." "You're right." And Jesus said, "To show you that the Son of Man has power on earth to forgive sins, I say, take up your bed and walk." Now, this is just a little footnote. This is a conference on apologetics. But this is one of many texts in the New Testament where a miracle evidences a message. That's one very important aspect of apologetics. Because Jesus said, your sins are forgiven. You can't say that. "Oh, yeah? Well, then how come I can raise this man off this bed? I guess I can forgive sin, right?" Okay, don't forget the point, though. This is a Son of Man passage. And he claims to be able to forgive sin. And the Jewish leaders say, "That's blasphemy." But he claims to be able to forgive sin. That's important. If you ask me, or I ask you, if we talked about this, what's the one verse you would use from the New Testament to show that Jesus was deity? How would you go after Dan Brown? I just did this recently in a class, and every single Christian response proposed a verse from the Gospel of John. All right. I won't give you my reasons, but I would use Mark 14, 60 or 61 to 64. And by the way, Mel Gibson did a great job of this in The Passion. But the high priest says to Jesus, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" Let's translate that. "Are you the Messiah, the Son of God?" And Jesus answers in Greek, make no mistake about it. Jesus says, "Ego eimi." Someone help me. What does that mean? "I am." Now see, a lot of Christians like to use John 8:58, "Before Abraham was, I am." That's tough to figure that one out. This is much more direct than that. "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" "Ego eimi." You say, wait a minute. You're talking about Son of Man here. That's a Son of God verse. You're right. We'll get there in a minute. But then he says, "And henceforth you'll see the Son of Man coming on the clouds and seated on the right hand of God." Uh-oh. Now he's really done it. Now, if Son of Man only means man, here's how the high priest should have responded. "No, look. I ask you if you are Son of God, okay? You're switching the channel on me. We're all sons of men. Let's go back again. Are you the Christ, the Son of God?" No, he doesn't say that. When Jesus says, "And henceforth you'll see the Son of Man coming on the clouds and seated on the right hand of God," the high priest tears his clothes and says, "What more need do we have of this? You've committed blasphemy." All right, let me give you the modern. Here's the way the high priest would respond in today's terms. Here's how the high priest responds today. "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? Ego eimi. And henceforth you'll see the Son of Man coming in the clouds and see the right hand of God." And the high priest would go, "Yes! Got him. Nailed him." You know, you have to understand this scene. This is a mano a mano scene. There are a lot of witnesses there, and they couldn't nail Jesus. And so the high priest steps up. After all, he's the scholar, right? This is an upstart Galilean carpenter. How can he joust with the head of the department? He's going to take Jesus on head to head. And you know what? He asked a really good question. And Jesus said, "I am." Now, what's so amazing about coming on the clouds and seated in the right hand of God? Coming on the clouds is a phrase used a number of times in the Old Testament, and it always and only refers to God. As innocuous a phrase as coming on the clouds means, this is an action of God. But the one that really got him in trouble is not even the ego of me. And it's not even the coming of the clouds. It's the a man, will be seated on the right hand of God. Here's what Jesus is saying. I will share God's throne. Bingo. You're a loser and you're dying. That's what happened. But notice, the most infuriating things he said were under the title Son of Man, not Son of God. Son of God's fine. It's a good, great title. We'll see that in a minute. But Son of Man is very lofty. In fact, I don't have time to go into this, but there are some first century Jewish writings, first century, 4th Ezra, nothing to do with your book of Ezra, 4th Ezra and 1st Enoch, especially 1st Enoch. These tell you what Jews believed in the first century. And there's a Son of Man figure who very clearly sits on God's throne and very clearly is worshipped. And Jesus is plugging into that figure. And the high priest has him cold. He does. He's got him cold. The only question is Jesus the Son of Man? But let's not lose sight of the comment. Dan Brown says this did not come about until Constantine divinized Jesus in the 4th century. And here's Jesus saying it plainly and going to the cross for it. All right, just a few conclusions here. Next.